For decades, the patriots of Eastern Europe fought against communism. Despite the threat of imprisonment and near total censorship, they continued to speak out. They called themselves dissidents. Ultimately, they prevailed against tremendous odds. Now, at long last, American patriots are speaking out against the forces that are destroying this country. This program is the voice of those patriots. This is American Dissident Voices. Your host is Kevin Alfred Strong.
In the early morning hours of December 4th, 1941, at a U.S. Navy shortwave monitoring station in Cheltenham, Maryland, a half-hour drive southeast of Washington, D.C., senior radio operator Ralph Briggs was just coming on duty. Briggs was 27 years old, had been with the Navy since the age of 20, and had worked with Naval Intelligence, monitoring foreign shortwave broadcasts for 4 years. He had been an amateur radio operator, call sign W9NCM, since he was a teenager. It seemed like an ordinary morning as he tuned his receiver to the station and began transcribing what he heard. At 8 a.m., he received the message he had been waiting for. It seemed to be nothing more than part of a regional weather forecast, the kind that the stations he monitored transmitted every day during their news programs. But Briggs, alone among the radio operators at Cheltenham, knew what the three words meant. They meant that the world was going to change in unpredictable but cataclysmic ways. They meant that many of his friends and countrymen would soon be dead. They meant that America would never be the same again. The three words were casually spoken during the regular news and weather feature from Radio Tokyo, Japan. The words were, "East wind, rain." Briggs immediately teletyped the message to Washington. "East wind, rain" was one of three possible execute messages which Japanese diplomats around the world had been alerted to begin listening for on November 19th. They were told to monitor the regular news and weather broadcasts from Tokyo, just as they always did, but to pay especially careful attention to the phraseology employed to describe the weather. If they heard the words "north wind, cloudy," it meant war with the Soviet Union. If they heard the words "west wind, clear," it meant war with the British Empire. And if they heard the words "east wind, rain," it meant war with the United States. Just a few miles away from Cheltenham, in Washington, D.C., at the Japanese Embassy, Chief Petty Officer Kenichi Ogimoto also was listening to the weather report. When he heard those fateful words, he immediately rushed into the office of the naval attaché, Captain Yuzuru Sanimatsu, and shouted, "The winds blew." Sanimatsu ran with Ogimoto back into the radio room just in time to hear the Radio Tokyo announcer repeat the weather forecast. "Higashi no kaze ami," east wind, rain. Instantly, workers at the embassy began destroying their cryptographic equipment and code books, while others took the secret documents from their files, piled them in huge heaps in the garden, and burned them. The Japanese diplomats knew that their embassies and consulates in the United States and its territories would soon be seized, and they themselves would soon be interned as enemy aliens, pending their exchange for American diplomats in Japan. All their code-making and code-breaking hardware and software, and all their secret papers, had to be destroyed immediately. The American government at that time was that of Franklin Roosevelt. It was the first presidential administration in the United States of which it can definitely be stated that it was fully under alien control. Never before had so many subversive aliens and traitors, many of them out-and-out communists, been ensconced in powerful positions. Never before had the federal government increased its power over the states and the people to such an extent. Never before, but often since. To give you an idea of the true atmosphere of the Roosevelt administration, which is assiduously hidden from you by establishment historians and was covered up by the controlled media of the time, let me relate a little incident recounted in John T. Flynn's book, The Roosevelt Myth. In 1939, a communist youth group calling itself the American Youth Congress was being investigated by the House Un-American Activities Committee, headed by Congressman Martin Dies. A group of communists from the Youth Congress, including their leader, Joseph P. Lash, Joe Cadden, and Abbott Simon, staged a series of protests against the investigation, at one point marching into the committee room and attempting to disrupt the proceedings. They jumped over tables, shouted at the congressman, tossed communist pamphlets around, and at one point, Joseph Lash even began singing a foul and insulting song directed at Congressman Dies. Present at the time, and leading the assembled communists into the chambers, was none other than the wife of the President of the United States, Eleanor Roosevelt. Not only that, but the communists had been chauffeured to their demonstration in official White House cars, and one of them, Lash, was living full-time at the White House, while Cadden and Simon, his colleagues, were often boarders there. A member of Congress who had been an ardent Roosevelt supporter visited the White House one morning. While there, he was amazed to see Abbott Simon, a board member of a well-known communist front organization, emerge from one of the bedrooms. He asked the White House usher if he had really seen what he thought he had seen. The usher assured him that he had indeed, and that Simon had been occupying the bedroom for 2 weeks, sleeping each night in a bed formerly used by Abraham Lincoln. In such an atmosphere, it is not surprising that the Roosevelt government was anxious to enter the war on the side of the Soviets. Nor is it surprising that Jewish interests, which also figured large in the Roosevelt regime and in all administrations since, were also zealous in their efforts to involve the United States in the war against Germany, which by that time had removed organized Jewish interests from their former positions of power in that country. But the American people were solidly against war, so much so that when campaigning for his third term in November 1940, while World War II raged in Europe and America was officially neutral, Roosevelt told the American people, in a speech in Boston, carried by radio and by wire around the nation, quote, "I say to you, fathers and mothers, and I will say it to you again and again and again, your boys will not be sent into foreign wars." Close quote. In fact, 1 week before Pearl Harbor, polls showed the American people a solid 75% against war, despite the best efforts of Roosevelt and the controlled media's hate propaganda. As we have already mentioned on a previous American Dissident Voices broadcast, Roosevelt's Secretary of War, Henry L. Stimson, entered in his diary 2 weeks before Pearl Harbor the fact that FDR had stated that day to his cabinet that his plan was to maneuver Japan into war without America firing the first shot. And that is exactly what he did. Among many other things, he instituted a trade embargo against Japan, starving that resource-poor nation of vital industrial materials. The Roosevelt government knew the meaning of the East Wind Rain message. They knew it because American and British intelligence were able to read the Japanese diplomatic code, and they had intercepted and read the message from the Japanese Foreign Ministry of November 19, 1941, which instructed Japanese embassies and consulates to be listening for the wind's messages on their shortwave receivers, and which explained the meaning of those messages in no uncertain terms. The powerful transmitters of Radio Tokyo broadcast the wind's message several times that day, and it was heard and understood not only by Naval Intelligence in Cheltenham, Maryland, but also by other U.S. monitoring stations around the nation, by the monitoring station of the Australian Special Intelligence Organization, located near Melbourne, Australia, by the British Intelligence Intercept Station on Stonecutters Island, Hong Kong, and of course, by Japanese diplomats around the world. After Ralph Briggs had teletyped the wind's message to Washington, it was quickly transmitted to Army Signals Intelligence and to the White House. The teletype equipment then in use at Cheltenham produced an original and a copy at the sending end, and two copies at the Washington end. Briggs typed out another original and two carbon copies on a regular typewriter. These were all carefully filed. Briggs was scheduled for weekend leave in Ohio the following Sunday, December 7, 1941. It was there that he received the initial news of the Japanese surprise attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. He and the rest of the staff at Cheltenham knew that war was imminent, but felt that America was forewarned and well prepared. He felt certain that the Japanese had fallen into a well-laid trap. In fact, the first and heavily censored news reports of the attack claimed that the Japanese had sunk only one old battleship and one destroyer, and that the Japanese had suffered heavy casualties. It was not too long before the truth came out, however, and Briggs and everyone else came to know what the Japanese commanders knew as they radioed back, "Tora, Tora, Tora," meaning tiger, 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 their signal indicating that the attack was successful and had been a complete surprise. Ralph Briggs' immediate superior was Chief Petty Officer Radioman Darrell Wiggle. In a recent interview, Briggs says, quote, "When I came off that weekend, I had a chance to talk with Wiggle, and I said, 'What happened?' And he said, 'I don't know. All I can say is nobody's talking.' And that was the end of our conversation. No one knew anything, so I let it rest, as by then, with war declared, we were very busy. But in the next month, as we began to hear the real facts about our losses, that's when I started looking back through our records for that execute intercept and to see what I'd done with it." Close quote. But Ralph Briggs found nothing in the files. Every copy of the wind's message had mysteriously vanished. On the 24th of September, 1941, the Army's shortwave radio monitoring station at Oahu, Hawaii, intercepted a message from Tokyo to the Japanese consul, Nagao Kita, in Honolulu. This monitoring station's job was to intercept all traffic to the Japanese consul there, and also all traffic on the Tokyo-Berlin and Tokyo-Moscow radio circuits. But none of the radio operators or code breakers in Hawaii were cleared to decode this material. It was all sent to Washington in encrypted form, exactly as received. The message to the Japanese consul divided Pearl Harbor up into several numbered target areas for an aerial attack, and requested him to make a twice-weekly report to Tokyo on the vessels at anchor in Pearl Harbor and their exact locations. Never before had the Japanese asked for such attack plan information about any American military installation. The codebreakers in Washington knew the significance of this message. They even called it the bomb plot message. Yet Washington did not pass this information along to the Army and Navy commanders in Hawaii. at least three messages about the bomb plan for Pearl Harbor passed between Tokyo and the Japanese consulate in Hawaii. All of them were read by Washington, the last that we know of on December 3rd. None were passed along to the American commanders at Pearl Harbor. The Roosevelt government not only was reading the Japanese diplomatic code, they were also reading the Japanese naval code. A strange twist of fate helped the American code breakers just a few days before the attack. The Japanese naval code was normally changed every 6 months. After each change, it normally took the British and American code breakers a few weeks to crack the new code. The next change date was December 1st. But due to the fact that some Japanese naval communication units had not yet received their new code books in time, the date for the code change was pushed back to December 4, thus giving our code breakers a valuable 4 extra days of Japanese naval intelligence. The Japanese also made the error after December 4 of communicating with some units who still hadn't received their code tables in the old code, while at the same time sending the same messages to others in the new. Slips like this are a code breaker's fondest dream and greatly speeded the process of cracking the new code. Washington knew through reading the Japanese naval traffic that all Japanese merchant vessels were to return to their home waters by December 7th. This information was also not given to the commanders at Pearl Harbor. Washington knew through reading the Japanese naval traffic that a huge task force, including a large group of aircraft carriers, was sailing into the Pacific on November 26th for an 8-day voyage and was to reach its standby position and refuel on December 4th. Washington also knew that there was no possible target in the Pacific that required the use of carrier-borne aircraft except Pearl Harbor. This information was not given to the commanders at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. On the 27th of November, Washington heard from the Dutch attaché in Washington. He had also received a decrypt of the Japanese naval message ordering the task force to sea from his own intelligence men in the Dutch East Indies. His analysis was that the task force's most likely direction was east and that its most likely target was Pearl Harbor. This information was not passed along to the American commanders at Pearl Harbor. And on December 2nd, the day after which the naval code would normally have been changed, Washington intercepted and read the message giving the date for the attack. Quote, "Climb Mount Nitikiyama, 12-8," close quote. Mount Nitikiyama was then the highest mountain in the Japanese Empire, and it was the code word for the attack to come. And 12-8? Japanese time is 12-7 Hawaiian time. This message was also intercepted and read by British intelligence, who concluded, according to one of their number, W.W. Mortimer of the British Far East Combined Bureau, that since no task force had been sighted in waters south of Japan, the only target that fitted the length of the voyage, mid-ocean refueling, and the inclusion of aircraft carriers was Pearl Harbor, and that an attack on Sunday, December 7th, the date given in the Japanese message, would offer the greatest element of surprise to the Americans. This information was passed along to Washington, who once again did nothing to warn the commanders at Pearl Harbor. Ladies and gentlemen, only in the last few years has the information obtained by the breaking of the Japanese naval codes become available to the public. But even the limited knowledge we had earlier of the decryption of the diplomatic codes was enough to indicate to any reasonable man that Franklin Roosevelt and the men around him should have been tried for treason and for the betrayal of every American fighting man. Not only those who died on that fateful day of December 7, 1941, but everyone who died or was maimed for life in that entire suicidal and fratricidal conflict called World War II. Until 1990, the United States government even refused to admit that the Japanese Naval Code existed, much less had been broken. But now, leaks uncovered by diligent researchers have finally thrown aside that curtain. The governments of the U.S. and Britain still keep a tight lid of secrecy on important aspects of the Pearl Harbor story. Many documents are missing from the records of the period. Some have been altered. What we do have, though, is so damning that no further confirmation of the essentials is necessary. When a patriotic administration takes power someday in Washington, the declassification of all records of the treason of the Roosevelt regime will fill in the details of this story, and no doubt other crimes will be uncovered. But on this we are certain. The administration knew at the very highest level what was going to happen at Pearl Harbor. They wanted it to happen because they wanted America to go to war against Germany. Since Germany would not do anything to justify an American declaration of war, despite Roosevelt's secret war against Germany in the Atlantic, and despite his multiple provocations and violations of American neutrality, Roosevelt was forced to provoke Japan, which was then Germany's ally. Roosevelt and his henchmen cared so little for the lives of American soldiers and so much for their plan to get us into the war that they chose not to warn our commanders at Pearl Harbor. Roosevelt wanted the Americans at Pearl Harbor to suffer a horrible defeat, so that the outrage of the American people at Japan would send the 75% of the American people who had been against the war down to the enlistment offices, and in this he was entirely successful. I have only been able to relate to you a tiny portion of the story of Pearl Harbor in this half hour. The events of December 7, 1941 were pivotal to the subsequent history of our nation and civilization. An understanding of those events will deepen your understanding of our nation's current plight. That is why we are offering you this week two of the finest books of historical research available on this subject. Infamy, Pearl Harbor and Its Aftermath by historian John Toland is the most comprehensive treatment of this story. It's clearly written, extremely well documented, illustrated, and it's nearly 400 pages in length. The second book, Betrayal at Pearl Harbor, by British intelligence experts James Rusbridger and Eric Nave, contains the very latest revelations from declassified documents and interviews with participants in the tragedy who have decided to break their silence after half a century. Although the authors shy away from indicting Roosevelt in the second book, the amazing wealth of facts they have assembled speak for themselves. We are offering both of these books this week as our radio offer number 35. For a contribution of $30 or more to keep this truth-telling program on the air. Send as much as you think our efforts are worth, a minimum of $30, to National Vanguard Books, Department R, P.O. Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. Remember to ask for radio offer number 35 when you write. I ask for $30, but I know that there are many of you out there who believe in what we're trying to do, who could easily send $300 or $3,000 to keep us growing. We recently added 6 new stations to our network. In Denver, Colorado, Colorado Springs, Colorado, Cheyenne, Wyoming, Phoenix, Arizona, Nashville, Tennessee, and Bakersfield, California. It costs us many thousands of dollars per week to keep our network on the air, and we must receive more support if this effort is to continue. I plead with each and every one of you to give all that you can give today while our precious right of free speech is still in force. Future generations, if there are any, will regard with favor those who did their duty.
You've been listening to American Dissident Voices,
a beacon of truth for patriotic Americans and for patriots of our Western civilization around the world.
American Dissident Voices depends upon the voluntary support of its listeners to stay on the air.
Please send the largest gift you can afford today.
Send $1 for a book and tape catalog listing over 300 titles that the controlled media don't want you to see.
Our overseas listeners can substitute two international reply coupons for the $1. For a gift of $12 or more, you can receive a high fidelity cassette recording of today's program.
Please give us the call letters of this station, the subject of the program, and today's date.
Write to National Vanguard Books, Department R, P.O. Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA.
That's National Vanguard Books, Department R, Post Office Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA.
That's National Vanguard Books, Department R, P.O. Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA.
And until the next broadcast, this is Richard Cotton reminding you, as always, freedom is not free, freedmen are not equal, and equal men are not free.
This program is pre-recorded and comes to you from the United States of America.